You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. Coming up later, we'll look at new guidelines on blood pressure and what they could mean for you.
Now, $2.7 million. That's the estimated amount of taxes women in Wisconsin pay each year for products such as pads and tampons. That's according to the State Department of Revenue.
Meanwhile, Wisconsin is among a growing number of states with proposals to create what sponsors call menstrual equity. A Madison state representative is reintroducing legislation that would exempt feminine hygiene products from state sales tax. A separate measure would require state-run buildings to offer those products for free.
Melissa Sargent is with us now. She's a Democrat representing the 48th Assembly District that includes parts of Madison, and she's the sponsor of those bills. Representative Sargent, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Wisconsin is among a growing number of states pursuing menstrual equity, and that's a term coined by Jennifer Weiss Wolf. And some states have already sought to remove sales tax on pads, tampons, anything that a woman might need during her menstrual cycle. Why do you think this is important?
Well, quite frankly, access to menstrual products, quite frankly, is a larger climb for many people in society than most people realize. And there are not other examples that we are able to land on that are a gender-based tax. And it is imperative that we remove the tax on feminine hygiene products, on menstrual products, because it is a gender-based tax. There's no other analogous sex-based tax on any other goods that people don't have the choice to use. And frankly, this is a public health issue.
Pads and tampons are taxed in the state. And while this isn't maybe the best correlation or the best example, but what about things like condoms or birth control? Again, recognizing it's not the best way to describe pads versus something like a condom or something.
Well, certainly. So birth control would be a prescription drug in most cases, and so that would not be taxed. However, in the state of Wisconsin, things like Viagra, potato chips, Kit Kat bars, gun club memberships, they are not taxed, and pads and tampons are. And they are taxed in most states. We consider taxes on items that are not necessity items, that are luxury items. And I've not talked to one person who menstruates that considers their period to be a luxury.
Now, Representative Sargent, what was the response when you first introduced these measures? This year is not the first time you've actually pursued this.
Yeah, this is the second legislative cycle that I've introduced this legislation for consideration in Wisconsin. And frankly, it's amazing how much this conversation has changed just over two short years. The first time we put this bill out, there was an awful lot of head-scratching and kind of visceral reactions to folks as we talked about the bill. And now, the second time we're putting this legislation out, we've seen a change across not only the state of Wisconsin, but quite frankly our nation and our globe, where people are realizing that we need to address the tampon tax. That it quite frankly is shocking, and I think most people don't realize that it existed before, and it's exciting to be part of this important movement.
So you've said that there's been a bit of a sea change just over the last 2 years from when you first introduced it to now. What have you heard from some of your colleagues that might have been scratching their heads originally to, you know, maybe what they're saying today?
Well, it's been again, very interesting conversations, not only in the state of Wisconsin, but across the nation, as I've been talking to other people. And, you know, this is an example of a gender injustice. And this is also an example where we're seeing people who are typically on opposite sides of issues because of partisanship coming together and working together for the greater good. It's very important that folks are realizing, and as time has gone by, there's been a seismic shift in the way people are thinking about this. This is economic discrimination on women, and menstruation is not a choice. Therefore, it should not be taxed. And it's exciting to be able to have these conversations with people and see how it is that their perspective has changed.
So playing devil's advocate for just a second, some people who might still be on the other side of this argument might use the argument that the tax being levied on menstrual products might not be that great, and it might be they might consider it more of a non-issue. Do you see maybe where they're coming from?
Well, quite frankly, this is a penalty against folks that menstruate in our society, and it's a very important conversation to be having so that what we're doing is leveling the playing field. People are not choosing to menstruate any more than they're choosing to exercise any other bodily function that occurs. And this bill isn't going to benefit anyone in particular. What this bill is going to do is to remove an inherent disadvantage that currently exists in our tax code.
And do you think that this legislation could pass this time around?
I'm very hopeful that this legislation is going to pass this time around. I have bipartisan support in the legislature here in Wisconsin, and at a time when it's hard to find that, that's an exciting first step, and I'm going to be working very hard with my colleagues to move it through the legislative cycle.
We're talking to State Representative Melissa Sargent right now. She's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 48th Assembly District. That includes parts of Madison. And Representative Sargent, you're pursuing this bill that would remove taxes on menstrual items such as pads and tampons, but you have a separate bill as well that would require state-run buildings to offer pads and tampons for free. Let's talk a little bit about why you wanted to pursue that.
Well, I know that access to menstrual products is vital for the health and well-being and full participation of women and girls in our society. And this piece of legislation, quite frankly, provides a message to folks that they need to be where it is that they belong, whether it is in school, whether it's at work, or whether it's where they are recreating with their families. Frankly, toilet paper is in every bathroom. And when men walk into bathrooms, every need that they have, the toilet paper, the hand towels, the sanitizer, the soap, it is provided there. And there's no question that it's going to be there. But for half of our population, for roughly three decades of their life, those products are not there. And it is important that we provide the message and provide access to menstrual products so that we can have true prosperity and equity in our community.
There has been some concern about the costs that would be associated with providing tampons and pads in bathrooms and state-run buildings. What do you say when you respond to people with those concerns?
Well, you know, I take very seriously my job as a state legislator, and part of that is making sure that we do have a balanced budget and we're being responsible with our hard-earned tax dollars. But at the same point, I have never had one person come to me and ask me how much it is that the state of Wisconsin pays for toilet paper in the bathroom of our state facilities. This is an example, a clear example of policies that were made when women were not at the table to be influencing the final decisions on what it is that is provided in our state buildings. And as we are having more and more diversity in our representation, we are able to have these conversations and ask these questions. Why is it that this is the case, and how is it that we can correct for this?
And you were part of a pilot program at Madison East High School where tampons and sanitary napkins or pads were made available for free in bathrooms. How did that program go from your perspective?
The program at Madison East High School was an amazing success. Quite frankly, we provided menstrual products in the bathrooms at the high school. And I was able to go in and participate in a few focus groups after they were installed. And hearing directly from the students, male and female students, as well as the staff at the school about the change that it provided, the fact that women and girls were able to go to the bathroom, take care of their business, and get back into their classrooms. They didn't have to go to a nurse's office, for example, to gain access to menstrual products. They were less likely to go home because they had to change. It was a great success. And now the Madison School District is actually looking at expanding this to not be a pilot program for our Madison schools, but to have it be in all of our middle schools and high schools.
So what's next in the legislative process for both the bill that you have on the table for removing the taxes on pads and tampons and for providing these necessities in bathrooms and state-run buildings?
Well, in order to address these common sense, pragmatic pieces of legislation, We are waiting for our committee assignments so that we can be working with the chairs and hopefully having public hearings. I still am encouraging. I have a great array of folks that have signed on in support of these bills in the legislature. But it doesn't hurt to have folks reaching out to their elected officials and asking them to sign on in support of the bills as well so that we can get those public hearings and bring them across the finish line. And frankly, if you live in a community that doesn't have this type of legislation introduced, I think it's vital that folks reach out to their elected officials and ask them to be the lead sponsor to start this conversation right in their own community.
Well, Representative Sargent, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Melissa Sargent is a Democrat representing the 48th Assembly District, which includes Madison, and she's reintroduced bills that aim for menstrual equity in the state. You can find copies of both bills at WPR.org.
Trapping and hunting gray wolves here in Wisconsin is currently forbidden under a federal court ruling that reversed an earlier decision that had removed wolves from the endangered species list.
Now, a new bill in the state legislature would end the DNR's efforts to manage the wolf population and remove penalties for killing wolves unless the federal government delists them as an endangered species.
Representative Adam Jarko is a Republican from the 28th Assembly District, including Balsam Lake. He's one of the authors of this bill. Representative Jarko, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, if this bill were to pass and this federal action weren't taken, we'll get to the federal side of this in a bit, what would happen? What would change?
If federal action were taken, is that what your question was?
If not, if the law passed and Congress didn't do anything, what happens under your legislation?
Sure. That essentially means that Wisconsin pulls out from the wolf management program. So Wisconsin currently acts as a partner with the federal government in enforcing the law as it relates to wolves and implementing a wolf management program. We would simply end that partnership. And the reason for that is we think that the federal government is acting in bad faith here by not delisting the wolf and leaving us with a population that is well over three times what the population goal has been.
And what kind of damage do you see from having the wolf population at that level?
It is significant damage. Senator Johnson, Ron Johnson, held a town hall meeting up in Spooner a couple of months ago, and the room was packed wall to wall with people telling their stories about how the wolves are impacting them. Senator Tiffany and I had a wolf summit in Cumberland last year, same thing. And you hear from farmers and ranchers, pet owners, hunters, that their cattle are being killed, that the deer herd is being killed, that they're scared to even go outside on a walk. It's a pretty significant problem and issue here. We heard from one farmer from Douglas County who said that their farm that had been in the family for over a century, he was thinking of shutting down because they just couldn't handle the stress of worrying if their animals are going to be slaughtered every night by wolves. Same thing with a high-end sheep farmer in Wisconsin, more in the central part of the state or north central part of the state. And it's just, they're just awful stories that you hear from these farmers. And the same thing with hunters and pet owners that suffer some of these same problems.
Now, we've heard from endangered species protection groups saying, according to some statistics, depredations by wolves, reports of those depredations are down in the state. The deer herd we've been hearing today as we come into hunting season has been on the rise in the state. Bigger numbers, bigger hunt expected this year. There are anecdotes, of course, but is it really the state of depredation that you're portraying here?
Well, last year was a record number of depredations, so I don't even know what they're talking about. Perhaps they've cherry-picked some numbers, which is what they like to do. But last year we had a record number of depredations. We have a record wolf population. So the idea that we don't have serious and significant issues is like burying your head into the sand.
Another concern that's been raised is that if these protections aren't in place, does that just in effect make poaching of wolves legal? And would this be a drastic reduction potentially in the wolf population back to dangerously low levels?
Not at all. What it means is if the federal government is so smart and they know everything about everything and they think that this is an endangered species, then they can handle it. Then they can enforce the law. They can give people tickets or prosecute them if there's a poaching issue. But the state of Wisconsin is not going to continue to act in this partnership when the federal government is acting in bad faith.
We're talking to State Representative Adam Jarko from the 28th Assembly District, co-author of legislation on gray wolves in Wisconsin, saying Wisconsin will stop its management, as we were just hearing, unless Congress takes action. And I think it sounds like that's your main goal here, Representative Jarko, to light a fire under Congress to get them to act. What are you hoping for from Congress?
Yeah, I mean, it's beyond my comprehension. We have a bipartisan bill that is languishing. We have Ron Johnson and Tammy Baldwin on the same bill as co-authors of it, along with Sean Duffy in the House and Colin Peterson, who's a Democrat from northern Minnesota. Well, this is a bipartisan bill. There is no reason that Congress can't get this done. In my understanding from Senator Johnson's office is we have 57 votes. We have all of the Republicans and a few Democrats. And I just encourage Tammy Baldwin to do her job. Get three more Democrats. Let's get this thing done for northern Wisconsin. It's not enough to just put your name on a bill. You actually have to go out and work it and get some of your colleagues on board. And I'm disappointed that Senator Baldwin hasn't done that yet, and I sure hope that this will help encourage her to get a few more of her colleagues onto this bill.
What should wolf management look like here in the state as you see it when it comes to killing wolves that do commit these depredations to a wolf hunt? What would you like to see happening here?
You know, we had a really, really good management plan in place for 2 years until the federal government, the court in Washington, D.C. stepped in and ended our plan. It worked just perfectly. The DNR managed it really well. They managed to a population goal, and they were doing a really good job of achieving that goal. People were happy. What happens is if you manage the wolf population to a reasonable number in the 350 range, the wolves tend to stay out in the woods and the forest. They're not feeling the necessity to come and kill livestock because there's just not that much food pressure like there is when there's so many wolves out there like there is today. And so you can see from DNR data the significant drop in depredations when we were doing our wolf management plan. And we just need to get back to allowing the professionals at the DNR to do what they do and manage this animal.
I've interviewed a couple of different wolf experts and predator experts, and there's a school of thought that says, yes, we've hit the levels we need to and gone over them. Some more management is needed. There's a school of thought that says, no, they're not in all the areas they used to be. We can definitely afford a bigger wolf population. What's your view as a legislator on the argument within the conservation community?
Well, I mean, the argument is not in the conservation community. Those who believe that that 950 or so wolves like we have today is not enough are on the extreme fringe. Even Senator Baldwin, who is a pretty liberal Democrat, believes that is too high of a number and it's time for Wisconsin to manage its population. If you think we're going to restore the wolf to its historic range, it's absolutely absurd that you would have wolves living in Madison. And maybe that's what we ought to do. I floated the idea last year of when we trapped troublesome wolves and bears, maybe we should relocate them to Madison, and then they'd take this issue seriously. And it's certainly tongue-in-cheek, but it is very frustrating for northern Wisconsin residents to hear from people who don't live here that we don't really have a problem. We're just kind of making it up. We know that we have a problem because we see it every single day.
Now, you and your co-sponsors, or co-authors, I should say, have this legislation. What are you hearing in the legislature from your colleagues in leadership about whether this might move forward?
I think there is an appetite, particularly among northern Wisconsin representatives and senators, to get something done on this front. And I'm really optimistic that we're going to move this forward, and we're going to put that pressure on Congress. And I'm really hopeful that Congress will do the right thing and return management to Wisconsin just the way they did with Idaho when Governor Otter in Idaho did a very similar thing out there.
I was going to bring that up, actually. Idaho passed a similar bill about 6 years ago or so, I think. Is your bill modeled on what happened in Idaho?
Yeah, that was an executive order from the then Governor Butch Otter, and it was very effective. It brought a lot of attention to the issue, and I think probably partially as a result of that action by the governor, Idaho was delisted and now can manage their wolf population. And that's all we're asking for, is that we allow the Department of Natural Resources in Wisconsin Minnesota, Michigan, and Wyoming to manage our own wolf population. We do not need Washington's interference in this issue.
As you mentioned, the wolf delisting from the endangered species list came from a federal court order. If Congress doesn't act on it, do you think that moving up in the court system might be another option to change things?
You know, maybe, but I've learned over the last number of years not to depend on the courts. Really, our job in the legislature and their job in the Congress is to make the laws, and we should not just rely on the courts to do these things for us. This is our job, and we ought to do it.
Have you heard from any members of Congress since you put this legislation out there, you and your colleagues?
Not directly, although I was pleased to see a couple days after it, Ron Johnson was asked about this issue at a public meeting or public forum, and he said, yeah, we really need to get back to pushing this legislation forward because, you know, frankly, he's right. There's not a lot that the state can do, so we're doing what we can here, but this is an issue for Congress, and they need to get on this.
We'll leave it there for now. Representative Jarko, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We've been talking to Adam Jarko. He's a Republican representative from the state's 28th Assembly District. We've been talking about a bill that he co-authored that would end protections of gray wolves here in Wisconsin and enforcement of related regulations unless the federal government, namely Congress, removes them from the endangered species list. This all comes from a federal court ruling that blocked the wolf delisting a few years back. Thanks to a new set of guidelines out this week, tens of thousands of Americans may find themselves with a new diagnosis of hypertension, more commonly known as high blood pressure. The American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology will now consider an adult with a blood pressure reading of 130 over 80 as having stage 1 high blood pressure.
And that's down from 140 over 90 and means that nearly half of American adults will now fall into the category of having high blood pressure. These new blood pressure guidelines are the first in 14 years.
Dr. Patrick Remington joins us now to talk about the new guidelines and what they mean for you. He is Associate Dean of Public Health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, what leads the medical community to reassess blood pressure guidelines like this?
Well, we've always known that the higher your blood pressure is, the higher your risk is of having a problem, a cardiovascular event like a heart attack or a stroke. And these categories were set decades ago for clinicians to be able to define somebody as being hypertensive or having hypertension. And that then allowed treatment guidelines to follow. And over the past several years, there have been studies that have shown that when you aggressively treat people below the traditional measure of high blood pressure, which was 140 systolic, that if you brought that down to 120 through aggressive treatment, that there were about 25% fewer cardiovascular events, strokes and heart attacks. And that's a significant decline. And so the feeling is that it's worth redefining high blood pressure from that older measure, the 140, down to 130.
So how many people are going to be affected by this, thinking they were in a healthy range and now in this low end of an unhealthy range?
Well, it won't change their blood pressure measure. Mm-hmm. Maybe it will increase it because they'll be more upset and nervous about it. But it will simply change the number of people who have now been classified as having stage 1 hypertension. And that's about 30 million people. That's a lot of people. Now, the good news is that when you follow through on these recommendations, that most of those will be recommended to improve their diet, cut out salt, certainly don't add salt, and look for low-salt options, eat more fruits and vegetables and more whole grain foods, and get exercise with an aim of losing a few pounds. And about 80% of the newly named hypertensives will have these lifestyle interventions recommended.
And there's a chart, and you've got it in front of you, that shows treatment for all the different levels over that healthy level. And it seems like lifestyle is part of the puzzle for everybody who has high blood pressure. Is that right?
Absolutely. Even for people with high levels of blood pressure or on treatment, lifestyle is always part of the prescription. But for some people, those are hard things to do. Mm-hmm. And for others, they don't work. And so then medicines need to be used.
So yeah, for those new people in that, I guess, 120 to 130 range, the first number in your blood pressure there, you said about one in five, I think, might need medication. What is the state of medication for blood pressure? What's out there?
Well, let me just, it's actually 120 to 129, and that now used to be called prehypertension, and it's now just called elevated blood pressure. It's really the 130 to 139 that's stage one hypertension. And the fact that I have to have a chart in front of me to remember these numbers and we get them wrong, what I encourage people to do is to simply continue to have a dialogue with your primary care provider about your blood pressure. Make sure that it's measured correctly. Sometimes we go in and they measure it over our clothing just after we've been in the exam room. There are good ways to have blood pressure measured. You should be resting. You should be seated. And it needs to be measured on several occasions. And once that's done, then have a conversation with next steps with your physician. But the numbers, I think doctors and health systems should pay attention to the numbers and the treatment. It's hard for people to keep track of this.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at new blood pressure guidelines and how they can affect our treatment. And that seems to be key. There is this handy chart with the numbers and the treatments, but it's a consultative process between patient and doctor and looking at other elements of health risk. Is that right?
Absolutely. And let me point out, there is some debate in the scientific community about these guidelines. For example, the studies were done in very, very controlled settings with people who were in clinical trials. In real life, sometimes it doesn't work that way. Patients might not be as compliant with respect to medicine. Sometimes the blood pressures that are measured in actual clinical practice are different than they might be measured in a clinical trial. So there's some people who have doubts that this will actually translate into changes in clinical practice. It will really take some time for people to realize that the guidelines are different, that treatments may be recommended, but more importantly, pay attention to the lifestyle recommendations that you know will come.
When should doctors be considering, though, a prescription, a medication for blood pressure?
Well, if you're in the stage one hypertension, so your systolic number is more than 130, and if your diastolic, the lower number, is more than 80, then you could have a conversation about whether it's lifestyle or whether you might need medications. Certainly medications have always been recommended for people with high blood pressure, 140 or 90, over 140 over 90. If your blood pressure is consistently over 140 over 90, you should definitely be in conversation with your physician and probably on medicine.
And these are, in some cases, medicines that have been around a long time. They've got a long track record of research and use out in the wild, right?
Yeah, they are very well known, very widely prescribed. But they can cause some side effects. First of all, for some people without insurance, they have a certain cost. There's sometimes co-payments that come along with them. And sometimes people have side effects, maybe dizziness in the elderly. So again, the conversation with your physician is really important to think about the balances of the benefits of medicine versus not.
And that's always a question when we expand the scope of people who are being diagnosed, the trade-offs between the benefits of a medication and those side effects. Is that something that's weighed in these new recommendations?
It is and it isn't. sometimes translating clinical trial results to actual practice, we find more costs in actually delivering these guidelines. The actual practice of measuring blood pressures and following up on patients can be more complicated than we think. And actually, compliance rates go down in actual practice. So the costs are ideally considered, but it's sometimes hard to actually know what it's going to be when it's in actual practice.
How about drug interactions, especially as you mentioned, with the elderly, with seniors? They might be taking the blood pressure medication and a statin for cholesterol and an antidepressant or a long list of potential prescriptions.
Yeah, and certainly Having other chronic conditions will increase the likelihood that you may need treatment, because the bottom line is that in this important study that just occurred, that they compared people being treated aggressively with people not being treated aggressively at the 140 level, and they found that 25% reduction in risk. But that means it went from 8% to 6% over 4 years. So you could say that you need to treat 50 people to save one cardiovascular event. And the 49 people that you're treating without benefit could have side effects. Certainly they have costs, they have visits to the doctor. So that's the balance that we need to play at this border between clearly treating high blood pressure and considering people at on the border.
We're talking about new blood pressure guidelines from the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology and what they mean for doctors, patients, and you. Our guest is Dr. Patrick Remington, Associate Dean of Public Health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Are you now considered to have high blood pressure under these new guidelines? If so, do you have any questions about what that means? If you're someone who has had high blood pressure for a while, what are you currently doing to try to get it under control? You can join us at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Patrick Remington of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. The American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology have issued new guidelines on blood pressure. And if you weren't considered to have high blood pressure before, you might have it now.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about these new guidelines and what they mean. Do you have questions about how these guidelines work, how they'll change medical care? Have you struggled with high blood pressure yourself? What have you tried working with your doctor to try and get those levels down? If you are in healthcare, what kind of conversations do you have with people about their blood pressure? Are you watching these new guidelines yourself? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Remington, I want to get back to the lifestyle side of this. You mentioned nutrition, the food we eat, of course, and maybe the food we don't eat for that matter, too. There's smoking. I imagine exercise is part of this. We've talked about a lot of different health topics over the years, and these seem to help in a lot of ways when it comes to high blood pressure, stroke, obesity, diabetes. This is a nice catch-all there.
Yeah, certainly. hypertension or high blood pressure is a phenomenon we see as people age. But in other cultures around the world, it's not associated with age. So there's something about aging in America. We tend to gain weight. We tend to become less physically active, and even our diets change. That, combined with the high rate of sodium consumption in the West, leads to increasing rates of high blood pressure as we get older. And so that then becomes a major public health problem. Again, as you said, 46% of Americans, by this new definition, will be considered to have high blood pressure. That's on the order of overweight, which is now 67% of the America is considered to be overweight. So it's becoming almost a normative condition.
So if you're in your office talking to your doctor about blood pressure, that's a medical problem. When you're talking about half the population, that's a public health problem. What kind of public health solutions do you see for some of these underlying causes of high blood pressure?
That's a great question. One is to work with industry to reduce the amount of sodium in prepared foods or restaurants. People put salt in foods because it makes the food taste better, but we know there's a risk associated with too much sodium in our diet. And so one thing is to just try and take sodium out of your diet yourself by not adding salt or adding it very infrequently. And the other thing is to look for changes in policies as to how much salt is put into foods. And the other issue is just the general recommendation to eat a better diet, eat more better foods, and fewer foods high in saturated fats, and to be physically active. Being physically active alone can improve your blood pressure. You don't have to lose weight. If you do lose weight, your blood pressure drops even more. But physical activity, good diet, and cutting sodium in your diet are three really important things to bring your blood pressure down.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Rich on the line with us in Neenah. Rich, hi.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up, Rich?
Well, you know, with the additional people being diagnosed with hypertension, it's going to also put a strain on people's wallets by having to go into the doctor, and also just trying to get into the doctor sometimes is difficult, just to get an appointment and that. I know personally, I used to have high blood pressure. I lost about 30 pounds, and now I don't take any blood pressure medication. I don't have to go in, you know, to the doctor every 6 months to have blood work and all that done to make sure everything's going fine. But you know, it is a financial strain on a lot of people to do that.
Rich, thanks for the call. Congratulations on getting that blood pressure down. But that financial burden you touched on earlier, Dr. Remington.
Well, it certainly is. And congratulations on losing 30 pounds. It's very hard to do. But hypertension is one of the few chronic diseases you can actually cure. By losing weight, 30 pounds is a tremendous amount of weight to lose. And it does reduce the need for medicine. And in Rich's case, eliminate it completely. Even a little more physical activity, even a little better diet and a little less sodium in your diet can drop your blood pressure a little bit and reduce the likelihood of you needing medicine.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rich. A lot of the attention in these new guidelines involves getting that blood pressure from, say, 130 down to 120 if you can. But how about those people with really high blood pressure, the 170s and 180s? Even if they can't get it all the way down to 120, is there some benefit to even getting halfway home?
Well, that was the debate in the medical community, was whether it was worth aggressively treating high blood pressure with people with 170 or 160 down to as low as 120. The evidence is that if you do it carefully, considering all these comorbid conditions and differences in the elderly, that you do see a reduction in heart attacks and strokes. Again, in actual practice, the medical community has to be very careful that the harms don't outweigh the benefits from more aggressive treatment of high blood pressure.
When we see a big announcement like this, this is one of those health stories that does make it into the mainstream news, but does it end up happening? Does this end up affecting what happens when that patient is talking to that doctor?
There's no question we're having a conversation now about high blood pressure. We might not have had that if these guidelines hadn't changed. I think it's important for people to realize that hypertension is a really important risk factor for heart disease and stroke. Those are incredibly important and common chronic illnesses, and everybody should be monitoring their blood pressure at least once a year at your doctor's office. And consider, if you have borderline hypertension or now elevated blood pressure, do some home monitoring. Pay attention to it and look for these lifestyle changes that can help bring it down.
And for people out there thinking, I don't even know what my blood pressure is right now, what's a good first step briefly to get started?
Well, the first thing is to visit your doctor. This is not a medical emergency. These changes of guidelines don't change how you should go in to see your doctor, how often you should see your doctor. But the next time you see your doctor, make sure that you pay attention to your blood pressure, how it's being measured, and what the numbers are. And then use those numbers in consultation with your physician as far as lifestyle changes.
It's a good place to leave it. Dr. Remington, thanks as always for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Patrick Remington. He's Associate Dean of Public Health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us to talk about new blood pressure guidelines and what they mean for doctors and patients.